following bit is from a previously recorded program on WAMF 90.3 FM on Chewing the Yak. Well, here we are on Chewing the Yak on WAMF FM 90.3 in New Orleans. And we're delighted to have my dear friend, Polly Waring, come on and talk about this great project that she is almost like a life's work at this point, I would say. It's been going on for a while.
Since 1979, at least 79.
And I say my dear friend because she is my dear friend, because she's such a wonderful and terrific, beautiful spirit. So I'm so glad that you're here.
Thank you.
Well, listen, it started out, as far as I can tell, as piano players rarely ever play together.
Yep. That was the genesis.
That was the documentary by your husband, ex-husband, Stevenson Palfy.
Right.
And that was in 1982. Is that right?
That's when it was released.
Well, I'll tell you, but now you've expanded it. You have a relatively new product here called Fess Up, and it has a feature-length interview with Professor Longhair, which is like 95 minutes.
Right.
And
it was really...
It's a two CD set, basically. Is that two or three? Two?
Two, okay. Yeah.
And so
one is the original documentary, Piano Players Rarely Ever Play Together.
Right.
Which is a documentary about three generations of New Orleans piano players who influenced each other's music.
And those three piano players are?
The oldest was... Toots Washington, who started out playing in the honky-tonks and the barrel houses and the prostitute houses. And the next was Professor Longhair, or Fess to his friends. And he used to hang out when he could with Toots. Toots used to let him sit in sometimes. And even though he was a teenager, he could sneak in there sometimes and sit in with Toots and his band. And then the third generation was Alan Toussaint, who was a huge fan of Professor Longhair's when he was growing up.
Well, it's a really interesting film. I mean, I've seen it. And one of the things that I was struck by was the deferential treatment attitude that Alan took towards the other two, because they were his elders. And, you know, Alan, I didn't know Alan too well. I had met him a couple of times, and he, one thing about him is he was a gentleman, seemed like, and decorum was important to him, and I was just struck by, because he was such a big star himself,
right?
Especially at that point, that he did show that deference of the student, basically to two people that he admired. So that was kind of a cool thing about the documentary,
right,
to me. And it was, the title itself says Piano Players Rarely Ever Play Together. So I guess there was kind of a, at some point there was kind of a rivalry or something like that between Toots and Professor Longhair.
Actually, there wasn't.
No.
That was taken from a line that Alan said during the filming. And he said piano players rarely ever play together because there are rarely more than
one piano
in one place.
Yeah.
Of course, now a lot of people do it.
Well, that's my beef with the piano. It's too big.
Yeah.
If it was just a little bit smaller, I would be okay with that.
Easier to move.
Yeah. But so that I guess that makes perfect sense that there is really, you know. Usually there's only one piano in a place,
right.
Yeah, so that would make it difficult.
Although, for this, there was a rehearsal that was planned, and there was going to be, during Stevenson's plan for the documentary was to interview each one individually and at their pianos and have conversations with them and talk about their style of playing and how they were affected and influenced by the other two, and then they were going to all play together in a concert at Tipitina's. But Fess died right before that was supposed to be. About 2 days before,
yeah.
And
so it ended up being
the two
a tribute.
Of them ended up having the concert anyway as a...
A tribute to Fats.
A tribute, yeah.
And also, there's footage of his... Of his funeral, also.
Right, yeah, there was.
There is. With the blessing of his family. Mm-hmm. Which, and of course, that is a, you know, that's a real part of New Orleans culture, is that kind of a send-off.
Yeah, I had never been to a musical wake before.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And it was something.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've expanded it now, and you have mm-hmm. this new product. It's like a little booklet, and it has two CDs, and it's called Fess Up. Like I think I said that at the beginning.
Right, and the reason we chose Fess was because in December will be his 100th birthday, his centennial. And so we wanted to have this out of respect for him. There's a Stevenson's editor. Stevenson had also started a documentary on Alan Toussaint, and he died before he finished that, and so he left it to his editor in his will, and his editor is finishing that. I think he may have finished it already. So there's already a good documentary about Alan, and there's so little about Toots. He didn't have much family, and I think he only has one record, although he did play with, oh goodness, I can't remember the musician's name, but he used to play with him.
Well, you know, you might want to get Fox News and CNN to, like, do the Toots, you know, documentary. They could just make it up. They could get together and divide by two. But that's too bad that there's not much, you know, that's one of the things about art. You know, if you don't get some kind of a record of it, it dissipates into the wind.
Right.
So this is really an important document that, you know, mm-hmm. Stevenson and you and others have put together. And
right, we had a good team.
It's especially, I mean, if you're really into New Orleans music, or just music in general, I mean, it's really fascinating and really well done. Mm-hmm. And if you're looking for a gift for a friend of yours or a loved one who... is really into music, I think this is really a terrific gift.
Right.
So we can't set any prices on our station, but you can tell us how to get it.
Yes. You can go to Louisiana Music Factory, either online, or if you live here, you can go down there. Or you can go to their storefront on Amazon. Amazon itself is selling it for more than our storefront, than Louisiana Music Factory. So it's best to just go to their website, which
okay.
is Louisiana.
So,
just
Louisiana
type
Music
in
Factory.
Louisiana Music
yeah.
Factory.
Okay. Well, listen, I know that you were there pretty much every step of the way in one way or another mm-hmm. with this. So how difficult was it to get them to agree to do this?
Not at all.
No.
No. I think he was anxious to, because he had just recorded his first real album, not real album, but his best album, right before he died. In fact, it came out right after he died, Crawfish Fiesta. And
talk about Alan.
Hmm?
You talk about Alan now?
No, I'm talking about Fess.
Okay,
yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But that's right, all of them have died at this point.
Right. So we're talking about Fess now. I just wanted to make that clear in my mind. I'm sure everybody else knew, but I didn't.
We had about 3 hours footage of each musician, like I said, sitting at the piano and talking about their lives. And so we culled the 3 hours from Fess down to about 96 minutes. And it's basically an autobiography of his life. There's some unbelievable stuff. He grew up in the 20s. Let's see, when was he born?
Well, it had to be 1918 if he's going to be 100.
Right. Yeah, 1918.
Yeah. Orleans Parish Schools, baby. I can add like a whiz. They used to call it arithmetic.
I'm from Mississippi, so that tells you something.
They used to call it arithmetic. Oh, you're a smart girl.
I moved away. I was smart. But anyway, he took that 3 hours, and or we did, and culled it into that
95 minutes.
Yeah.
That's what it says on the back.
On the second DVD. And it really is something.
Yeah, I bet that is.
But
I
it's in
seen
a
that.
Book. It's in a book form.
It is.
I call it a digibook.
Right.
And
you
we tried to find as many unpublished
photos.
Pictures as we could, yeah, because there's so many that have already been seen of Fest.
Right, yeah, it's very nice. It's very nice. I have one in my hand right now, and it's very nice, and it's text and photos along with your...
And we have three great essays by, let me see, there's one of the writers is from San Francisco, a musician from San Francisco. His name is Johnny Harper. And one we have, he's so funny. When he talks, he has his own vocabulary, and it's hard for people to know exactly what he's talking about. And so we've got an
interpreter.
Yeah, we've got a...
for the educationally impaired.
Yeah.
Those who actually can speak English. Okay, no. If you're speaking a different language that doesn't exist except
well,
in your own mind.
Each subject is explained.
It's kind of like Dr. John sometimes when he says something, he makes up words.
It's a glossary.
Oh, okay.
And that was written by Michael Oliver Goodwin. He also used to be from San Francisco, but he now resides in New Orleans.
Yeah,
they made him leave.
Or maybe we entice him to come, I should say.
Right.
You never know.
And and there's also a wonderful review that Michael Oliver Goodwin wrote when he came down for Fess's funeral, which is also great. And let me see.
What we're gonna do right now is we're gonna do a little excerpt from the DVDs,
yeah, great.
Either music or words. I'm not sure what we're going to go to, but we'll go through that right now. We'll come back in a second.
Okay.
Let me know when you're ready and we'll come back.
Okay. Bruce Rayburn was head of the Hogan Jazz Archives.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So that was a little bit of an excerpt from the Fess Up, basically, the feature-length interview with Professor Longhair and also Piano Players Barely Ever Play Together, which is a documentary of the three players, Toots Washington, Alan Toussaint, and Professor Longhair playing together. And we're here with Polly Waring, one of the producers of this particularly beautiful piece of art here, of film and text and photos, called Fess Up, which you can get at the Louisiana Music Factory. And before we left, you were talking about some of the writers that wrote the booklet.
Right. There was another writer, Bruce Rayburn.
Oh, yeah.
Who used to work at the...
jazz historian.
Yeah, he was head of the Hogan Jazz Archives at Tulane University. And he just recently retired and moved to Oregon. So we were really pleased that he was able to write...
Yeah,
beautiful.
There's no email
essay.
In Oregon, so you couldn't send anything from there. I've been there before. I'm telling you, it's a terrible place. Okay, no, actually, it's a nice place. It's green. It's very green. It's very beautiful.
Oh, it is.
So you get out there and you just walk through the woods.
It ain't New Orleans.
And you play gin rummy with beavers. So, well, listen now. This has been, 1982 is when the Piano Players first mm-hmm. came out to really great reviews.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you about Alan's documentary, because I know that was in the works, and I never know what happened to it. So you think it's almost finished?
I know it is, yeah.
Okay. So when do you think that'll be coming out?
I'm waiting to look for Russia soon. He's like Stevenson. Stevenson took forever to finish a piece.
She's talking about the original director, Stevenson Palfy, her ex-husband, who was the auteur, the filmmaker of Piano mm-hmm. Players Rarely Ever Play Together. And he was working on a documentary about Alan Toussaint, and which lasted for how long did that, since from beginning to end, was that?
Well, he had already recorded interviews with the Pointer Sisters and just about everybody that sang any of Alan's songs. And he was going to be recording other artists when he died. And so I know that Aaron Walker, who took over the documentary, Had a few more interviews, and he's finished with it now. I'm looking forward to seeing it.
So you really haven't seen, so you don't really know how it's going to come out
yet?
No. Oh, so you must be very anticipatory of that.
Right.
Well, great. Well, that'll probably be out for next Christmas or something like that.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, mm-hmm. since Christmas is fastly approaching.
Well, so what we've been doing is going from one city to the other, showing it, and it's gotten great response. We've gotten great response.
The piano player's one?
No.
Well, the Toussaint.
Most people are familiar with piano players. Now, well, yes, we do play like a double feature if people want to.
But you've been playing the Fest thing, or?
Yeah,
okay.
We do that because
the other thing's not finished yet.
Yeah, and there's hardly ever been any interviews with Fess. I think there was one back in the early 70s, but he was pretty sickly at that time. He didn't really get a second wind until Allison Minor and Quint Davis found him and had him at the first Jazz Fest. Actually, George Ween heard his Mardi Gras song on the radio and wanted to know who that was, and Quint didn't know. And so George Ween said, well, I'll find him. I love him. He's great. He's different. Find him. So they went looking for him. They did their gumshoe work and found him working at the One Stop Record Shop, sweeping floors and doing odd jobs. And once they asked him if he would be involved, all of a sudden all of his aches and pains just sort of went away, and he got much better. He had been pretty sick.
Well, that's a good story.
Yeah, and he had a great several years with Alan. I mean, with Quint and Allison, and he died very unexpectedly in his sleep.
How old was he when he died?
He was. Let's see, died in 1980.
Okay, so that would be 20, 38, 72. No, he'll be 72.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure it out.
Oh, wait, no, he was 68. Somehow.
Okay, well, he was 68. Doesn't matter to him now.
No, it doesn't. But I was thinking, wow, he was really young.
Yeah,
I'm 68.
Especially if you're 69, yeah.
Well, I'm 68, and I think I'm younger than that.
Yeah,
feel
yeah.
younger than that.
Yeah, you. Well, actually, you are older than death. I mean, you're still alive, so.
Right.
So, well, that's a. I mean, it's too bad that they had to discover him, because that meant that he was just kind of like not really performing evidently too much. But it's good that he was discovered.
No, and he said he didn't blame it on the record companies, because some of the record companies had come down here and recorded him. And said, you know, you've got to give us this much money so we can send it out to L.A. and have it whatever. And he'd never hear from them again.
Yeah.
But
he didn't blame them.
No, he said he didn't blame them because he didn't tour. He didn't want to tour.
I see.
His wife was sick most of the time, and he wanted to be closer to home. He did do several. He went to England and for a birthday party for Paul McCartney, and no, he did go to England. He did a European tour, but he did a birthday party for Paul McCartney on the Queen Mary, and I think there's an album. There is an album of that party.
Okay. And you said Toots didn't have too many recordings at all.
No.
So his work on this.
Oh, Smiley Lewis was the man he used to play with a lot.
Okay. Well, you know, I know you knew Alan pretty well. Mm-hmm. What was his feelings about the film, if any? I mean, was he pleased
or
not pleased?
Well, it's interesting. When Stevenson and I took it over to his house the night that it had been finished and it was ready to show, and actually, he was one of the first people we showed it to, so we didn't know what to expect. And he didn't say a whole lot, but we could tell that he really liked it. He didn't say a whole lot because he's very...
He's kind of quiet.
Quiet, yeah. And humble. But he did like it.
Well, you know, he must have liked it well enough if he decided to let Stevenson do another one about him.
Right.
So yeah. I would guess that was kind of a stupid question, but I'm mm-hmm. kind of a stupid guy, so that's okay. And, I mean, it's consumed a lot of your time, hasn't
yeah,
it?
A lot.
And energy as well.
Right.
So
my daughter died 2 years ago, and I needed something to take my mind off of that and
sure.
get busy. So that's about the time we started doing this. We had a benefactor who lives in Spain who gave us some seed money, and really helped. Without him, it wouldn't have been done.
Okay, well, that's good that it was yeah. done, yeah. It seems like an incredibly worthwhile endeavor, and I think that a lot of people will be interested in it. Again,
well, I hope so. It does make a very unique gift if
yes.
anybody in your family or your friends enjoy music, especially piano.
For those of you who are watching this on radio, it's a little booklet with a picture of Professor Longhair on the cover, smiling, and it's called Fess Up. It's two... CDs.
DVDs.
I'm sorry, DVDs, pardon me. DVDs. And so little difference between a C and a D. They're right next to each other in the alphabet, but it means so much. DVD. We have a 95-minute DVD of a feature-length interview with Henry Rowland Byrd, a.k.a. Professor Longhair, which is pretty unusual, like as Polly has told us. But you also have the 76-minute documentary Piano Players Rarely Ever Play Together with Professor Longhair, Toots Washington, and Alan Toussaint Pratt, and that the meat of it, of course, to me was the rehearsal, because it,
right,
it finally came together
right.
where they had
well,
all three of them.
That was the only time the three of them played.
Right,
together.
It was the only time, and they got together for that rehearsal. And you mm-hmm. had the rehearsal here chronicled, where you can see it with the three pianos together. So it's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're really a piano aficionado, this is really right up your alley. Believe me. It's well done, it's critically acclaimed, and it's packaged very well.
I'd like to mention, too, our website, because you can read a lot of the reviews. Well, I'm proud of the reviews that we've gotten from it.
Sure, well, go ahead and give us the website.
The website is Fess Up at palfeyfilms.com. And if you go to our Facebook page and like us, that would be quite something. I would appreciate it.
Okay, so that's Fess Up at Palfey Films. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Fess Up at PalfeyFilms.com.
And Palfey is P-A-L-F-I. P-A-L-F-I for all of those out there who need to have spelling. Well, Polly, I really appreciate you coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh,
I
it's my pleasure.
Enjoyed being here.
My pleasure. And we're gonna play a little bit of the interview with your permission. To end the show.
Oh, yeah, please do.
And also some of the music as well that's on the Piano Players Rarely Ever Play Together. Again, it's called, the package is called Fess Up, and you can get it at Louisiana Music Factory. It's probably the best way for you to get it locally. And I don't think they listen to us anymore in Denmark, so probably the people who listen to it probably all local since. I thank you for coming, Polly.
You're very welcome.
And I'll let... Let the content speak for us the rest of the way.
All right.
And I'll come in at the end and give another plug to one about the Louisiana Music Factory and the names and what it is. Okay?
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, now we're going to listen to a little excerpt from the interview with Professor Longhair from the 2-DVD set, Fess Up, that you could get at Louisiana Music Factory. And now we're going to listen to a little something off one of the other DVDs from Fess Up, and this is from Piano Players Never Play Together. This will be some music from Alan Toussaint, Toots Washington, and Professor Longhair playing together.
So you weren't born here, right? You were born there.
I was born in Bogalusa.
Yeah, yeah.
And my mother brought me here when I was around about 2 months old. And I've been here ever since.
Now, your mother was a musician. musician, right?
Right.
What did she play? She played a bunch of things, right?
Well, my mother taught me practically everything that I do and I know now, you know. And some of the things now, I mean, you all wouldn't know anything about, but I don't do them anymore. And that's playing drum, dancing, playing a guitar, harmonica, ukulele.
And she played all that?
Juice harp. My mother played anything she picked up.
Okay, yeah. Now, it's in something I read, you said your mother played sideshows. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's like minister shows. You ever seen Amos and Antony and them when vaudeville, when they put this, what's the name of this comedian? It's a white comedian. He sings a lot of black songs. It was way back now.
You hear about Al Jolson?
Al Jolson. Yeah. Well, that's what they call side shit. It was comedian, yeah. Vaudeville, things like that.
She traveled with it?
Yeah, she used to travel. I guess that's the reason why my daddy left, you know, because he couldn't put up with it, you know. I guess. I'm not for sure, because I didn't never have a father. All I had was a mother, you know.
So she traveled. He wasn't a musician, right?
Yeah, he used to be a musician, too, but he quit. I guess he wanted to settle down, and she didn't, you know.
Do you know what he played?
No, not bass. I think he played bass. But during them time, it was upright basses, you know. We didn't have these electrical basses out there.
Now, she played?
She played anything she touched. Piano, guitar, drums. Spoons, harmonica, juice harp.
So you had a piano in the house?
Well, I didn't actually exactly have one in the house. But it was world lines. I think it was world lines then. It used to take old pianos like this one when they couldn't really, you know, put them together. They'd set them out on the street. Mm-hmm. Trash would pick them up. And we'd drag them in the house or in the alleys in different places. And I learned how to fix pianos this way. I mean, if I didn't play, I'd get hammers off of one piano and put them in the other and get the little pads that make the action down here. If it wouldn't work, I'd tie a cord string or thread in it and bring it up to the next notch and tie it in where the action would work, you know. So I got them to play some keys with it and some didn't, you know. But just with a broken piano that I had in the house, he taught me a lot. This is why I learned how to start cross-cording piano. If he didn't play, it didn't matter to me. I'd find some other key to substitute, you know. Mm-hmm. So I do that a lot right now sometimes, because this piano does that sometimes. Way up in the action, it's a little too tight.
Yeah.
So I have to skip them.
So in other words, a lot of things you did, you made compensation for the fact the piano was bad.
Bad piano, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I didn't have no more this much of a piano to really play on. Got three keys. I ain't using but two fingers. And this is all I would have to work with, just in this section.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, well, I've developed, you know, more sounds in my mind that I like to execute. So. A lot of more keys, you know, but if I don't have them, well, I go back to where I first started from, with the three keys or two keys, you know.
Did you or your mother ever play in one of those medicine shows?
My mother?
Yeah.
No, she had quit playing for the public when I got big enough to start to play, but she would play for churches then, you see. But when we get back home, well, and she showed me a lot of things that she wanted me to know, but I just got away from what she was playing because I didn't like swing basses. I wanted to do what the fellows were doing in the ballroom, the speakeasy.
How much actually formal training did you have? Did you have any where somebody sat you down, lesson number one, lesson number two?
My mother started me playing, really. So I learned the keyboard sound of the piano before I even hit the streets. But after I started coming in the streets, then I started developing other sounds from other musicians that I liked to hear play.
Tell me about now starting out. You started out in the spasm bands, right? With the makeshift rhythms and the tin cans and stuff.
Yeah, well, those little instruments we built ourselves. But like I said, we weren't able to buy no instruments. And we had to make our own. We had little dime horns. I don't know if you're familiar with them. A little horn about that long. You screw the top off and put a cigarette paper in it and screw it back. And do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Well, some fellas got a good sound out of that. And I don't know if you ever heard of Noon or not. He made a kazooka out of one of these little horns, put in here with a long pipe and a funnel on the end. And some of the fellas got big tubs, and they put string in the tub and a long stick to stand on the tub, and they would make a bass out of the tub. Well, this is where we made our instruments, and we just didn't have a drum then, so we got a soap box, and we used to go down and these big reels at the pitchers. Moving pitchers comes in. We get a couple of those and make a cymbal out of one and a snare drum out of the other. We get a tomato can, an okra can, and potted ham can. We make our different little tum-tums out of those, on nail them on the box. We get a piece of shoe tongue, a leather, and put it on the stick at the bottom where it would make a flop sound and hit the bottom. We put the heel on another stick and then put a little rag or something or a piece of rubber on the top of this stick. It was contracted with me where the drum would hit up against the box. Sometimes we put a pan or something behind that to make a bigger sound. We could change sound with this pan. And you pick up maybe $50 or $55 or $60 in a week time like that. And we divided up among who all was working in my group. You know, that was the bass and the drum and the horn and harmonica, whatever they had, a juice hop. And we had three dancers. Sometimes I'd get out and dance. Somebody else would play the drum. We had to make a living. We wasn't playing. We wasn't shucking. We were working.
When did the whirlwind?
That's when I started the boxing.
Yeah.
See, as long as I was whipping the other guy, I was whirlwind. But the day the guy whipped me, I give that up, you know.
How did you start in a career as a boxer?
I was just good. I was fighting anyway. You had to fight down here. If you want to cross Canal Street or Melpomene Street or Luther Avenue, you'd be just getting ready to fight if you're going on the other side of these streets. And I was pretty good. But after I got in the ring, it was a different situation. It wasn't too much space to run around in, you know. And this guy caught up with me one night, you know. And he did me in pretty bad. No matter the matter I got, the more he was battering me around. So I said, well, this ain't for me, you know. So then I give that up and went back to gambling.
Did Jack Dupree have anything to do with you entering the ring?
No, he talked me into it, you know. It was easy money, but him having anything to do with me getting in there, no, not really, because I never really saw him fight either, you know. He was a comedian when I met him. He was doing a lot of singing, and I was playing the piano. I was a one-man band then. You see. I used to kick the side of the piano with my foot like that for the drum for my own time. And then I would play the piano, but I just wasn't singing then. So he said, man, you can really play. He said, if I could play like that with the songs I got, I could get rich. I said, yeah, if I could sing like you with the way I play, I said, I believe I could get rich. So in turn, we help one another in these problems, you know.
And one thing I was interested in is that you got a progression here. You went from dancing to playing drums to eventually playing piano.
No.
You're interested in the rhythm, right?
Yeah.
Basically, how is that translated, you know, from kind of dancing you would do to the drumming to the... to the piano playing? What kind of rhythms did you like?
Well, they call it soul these days. Whenever you hear any musician say soul music, this is what it represents. Something with a lot of rhythm in it and a good pattern, you know. Then it takes other musicians to bring in the background and the beats. So this is why I say you got to break men's in. It ain't just like a sheet music that you can hand to everybody and they just up and play it. You like, we get to start and they'll say, sing like, go to something like so.
Rhythm.
Yeah. Now you gotta get a beat to this.
Yeah.
Then you gotta get a background to this. Then you gotta fix solos in this. It's a whole lot of work, you know what I mean? And you gotta know who's gonna take the solos or who's capable of taking the solos. And I think Mac is the perfect fella with guitar. Snooks is a good boy. But lately, Snook got his own ideas because he is a creator too. Snook Eglin, if you heard of him, he's a blind, he plays guitar. Gatemouth Brown is an outstanding guitar player, but these fellas are automatically artists themselves. Like Mac. Mac is just doing me favors because I have done him favors, but I'm in no position to hire Mac to play with me, you know, because he is an artist.
Originally, this started out to be a music performance by three gifted New Orleans piano players who influenced each other's music, featuring each executing his individual style, and culminating with all three playing a number together. It evolved, however, into a more intimate and complex story. In the 70s, Toots Washington is considered the grand old man of New Orleans piano. He started out playing blues and jazz in the honky-tonks and succeeded in becoming a versatile piano player by devoting his life to mastering the keyboard. He was also the inspiration for many young musicians, including a teenager named Henry Bird, who became known as Professor Longhair. Professor Longhair, or Fess to his friends, has been credited by music scholars and critics with inventing an original style of rhythm and blues. Like Toots, Fess was idolized by young musicians, especially Alan Toussaint, who based one of his early songs called "Whirl Away" on Fess's style. Unlike Toots and Fess, Alan shies away from the stage and devotes his considerable talents to writing and producing. On rare occasions when he does perform, he plays his own material, which represents some of the most popular songs of the last 20 years.
Toots?
Fifth?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm older than Fifth.
He is the first one outside taking up time with me. It was such as a...
I used to play in a joint called the Cotton Club on Rampart, and he used to be in there. He used to follow me and this fella. We liked him because he come up in town around us, see.
You hear what I do then? No smears. He had straight, clean fingers. That's what he taught me. And a lot of piano players you catch today that's playing, they make a lot of blunders in this.
Well, he used to sit around and listen at the music. He wasn't playing in at all. So he, every chance I'd catch him, run into him, I used to show him how to play blues.
I did then, I missed it then. But this is what he often tells me not to do. Don't miss your keys, because they will show up. Well, I missed it on paper, but I just want to let you see it, you know.
That was around in the, ought to have been around the late 30s.
It was very exciting to me to hear Fess along here. And throughout my childhood, whenever there was a Fess record nearby, don't care how far it was, I would find it and learn it. And I just idolized him. So it was always a pleasure and quite a lesson and a milestone to hear one of Fess's new records.
You didn't come completely to what I was doing, but it was some of my things right on. It was all.
It had some flares of Fess all over the place, just flares of Fess.
This is where he will always step up from, just a sound. It was just a sound he liked it, and he named it what he wanted, which was World Away.
And Alan Toussaint is great. He's a good composer.
Alan Toussaint's a swell musician.
And he's good. He's another one. He's a good versatile piano player, too.
If you ever let him play his standings of what he was taught and what he learned before he met me.
Take care of the children of the world. They're all strong as hope for the future, the little bitty boys and girls. Make this land a better land in the world in which we live. And help each man be a better man through the kindness that you give.
I would be a good piano player that could play more than blues. See? But this was merely a gift, God's gift, a gift, because my aunt used to run me off the piano. That's why I say it was a God's gift, because she didn't want me to play. She'd go get me a job in the hardware store. Wash dishes in the cafeteria and places. See, it'd run me off the piano, but I'd stay on it every day and I would she'd go to work. I practiced on a little everything. Play the blues, play the boogie woogie and sentimentals and everything. I go over everything. I play a little classics too. There's a classic, the Russian Lullaby. You ever heard that? Thank you. piano player with no left hand is no piano player. He's just what you call a one-hand piano player. He concentrates just on the right hand, see? The better, any piano player, not only me, any fella that plays a piano, he got 88 keys on you. You don't just play with your right hand and not use nothing. You're just doing nothing. A lazy left hand. The better the left hand is, the better your music sounds.
I can't reach over there.
Following bit is from a previously recorded program on WAMF 90.3 FM on Chewing the Yacht.
We're here with Ronnie Virgits, and that's him, and Chris Champagne, that's me, and Ronnie's a fan of racetracks.
How are you doing tonight, Ronnie?
I am doing great, Chris. I'm thankful for
there
how
you
good
go.
I'm doing.
Well, good. Well, good. It's a beautiful autumn day in Louisiana today, so we all should be thankful for that. And of course, Thanksgiving's coming up here, and in New Orleans, that means only one thing, right? That means
yes, it does. It definitely does.
It's like a secular religious holiday almost. It's opening day of the Fairgrounds racetrack.
Yes, it is. Since 1872 or something.
Yeah, 1872. Yeah. Actually, I think that they. I was doing some research for a new racetrack show, and they had a track in Jacksonville, Florida. In the 1920s, and their opening day was Thanksgiving Day as well. So I thought that was
okay.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Well, listen, do you have any Thanksgiving memories that you'd like to share with us from the fairgrounds?
Well, you know what? I do. this is sort of a fairgroundsy kind of thing. I was... for some reason, in those days, I couldn't get in the fairgrounds, and I was there must have been an age limit. But me and a couple of friends of mine went one Thanksgiving, probably pedaled our bikes out to the fairgrounds, and you know, maybe climbed on top of a shed on one of those streets and was looking at the thing, and the Thanksgiving handicap was won by a horse named Tenacious, who was he was kind of a well-known horse around. He ran great at the fairgrounds, not so good anywhere else, but he loved his track, and I remember him, you know, getting up. He was a late charger, and he got up and won the Thanksgiving handicap, and to me that was that was better than cranberry sauce any day.
There you go. You know, I think that was Mrs. Joe Brown's horse, wasn't it?
Yes. I believe it did. It belonged to the Browns. That's correct.
That's one of the horses' names. I think that I remember. One of the first horses' names that I think I remember. Race horses, actually, from my background, because my dad worked there for years, and my mom as well, and. I do remember that horse very well. He won, I think, the New Orleans Handicap 2 years in a row, I believe.
Yeah, I, like I say, he was around here. He was tops. Like I said, he didn't carry his New Orleans success around quite as much. But he was a good horse, and down here he was great.
Right. There's a bar actually named in the. I don't know if you're aware of that. There's a bar in the fairgrounds now named after him. The bar up that's in front of, on the fourth floor there, in front of. Where
yeah,
you might find
and,
me.
Yeah, that was actually the first word that I knew of. I believe is that four syllables? Tenacious? No, three. Anyway, the first three syllable word that I.
that you ever learned.
That I ever knew, yes, exactly. It might have took me a couple of years to learn the meaning of it, but it was a cool name, too.
Well, you know, Thanksgiving weekend is really the busiest time for the track in the whole season, really, except for a few, you know, like Louisiana Derby Day. Like tomorrow is Thanksgiving for as we tape the show, and I'll be going out there for my umpteenth Thanksgiving Day there. And you know, even before I worked there, I mean, my dad did, and Thanksgiving Day for us was always, you know, we'd. We had to wait till the end of the day to have our dinner because my dad was working.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been part of my life, this Thanksgiving Day opening at the fairgrounds for forever. And and I know it's something that, like I said before, it's kind of like a religious holiday for some people because they wait for that day all year round after it closes because, you know, because you only have it for 4 months, the track here. And people take that stuff seriously.
More than that, Chris, I think there were actually some people who only went to the fairgrounds once a year, and that was on Thanksgiving Day.
Yeah, maybe so.
I think, some of the sort of the socialites, if you want to call them that, a lot of them, Thanksgiving, that was where they did their Thanksgiving. And they might have not been out there any other day, you know?
Well, the holidays around the track are... you know, par for the course. I mean, they used to run on Christmas Day. You know, they don't do that anymore, but they used to when horse racing was a little more popular. And, of course, they had that horse Santa Claus that won a couple of times, I think, on Christmas Day.
Yes.
And, of course, the Mardi Gras thing is a lot of people in New Orleans, you know, New Orleans, of course, is famous for Mardi Gras, but it's also a lot of people who have been here for all their lives. They don't like Mardi Gras for one reason or another, the traffic and whatever where they live. And some people go skiing. That became a thing to do on your four-day weekend. But also go to the fairgrounds is another tradition on Mardi Gras Day to go out there. I can remember when I was very young, my mom would take me out to the parades because my dad was working that day, and I'd be, you know, in some kind of costume, and we'd go out to the track because you hit the parades early, and the track didn't start until like, you know, 12:30, 1 o'clock, so you could do the parades in the morning and go out to the track and make a full day of it, you know, New Orleans style.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there'll be a lot of people out there this year eating their turkey with the horses, and you know, they tried to start the season a little early a couple of years ago by having a couple of extra weeks head start to the, you know, and have the official opening on Thanksgiving, and they got a lot of flack because, you know, you try to change anything in the world. I mean, you can try to pick up a piece of trash on the ground and people say, oh, you can't.
You run into a little resistance.
You can't pick up that trash because that's historical trash, you know, something like that, you know.
It's not trash, by God.
You've been listening to Chewing a Yat with Chris Champagne on WAMF 90.3 FM, New Orleans. Thanks a lot for listening.
This program is produced by WAMF 90.3 FM in New Orleans, Louisiana, and distributed by Affiliated Media Foundation Movement to our sister stations WDSV 91.9 FM in Greenville, Mississippi, and KABF 88.3 FM in Little Rock, Arkansas. For more information, please visit our website at affiliatedmediamovement.org.